You know, I'm not really supposed to speak with strangers, but we've met before. Welcome to Coast. My name is Richard Serrett, sitting in for George Norrie. And George, as you are all aware by now, recently lost his sister to cancer. I know you're keeping him and his family in your prayers, and George, I want you to know that you're in my prayers and thoughts tonight as well. Tonight, this morning, the broadcast comes to you live from Coast's Toronto affiliate, Talk Radio AM 640. And another remarkable twist in the ongoing saga of the Ford family here, for you keeping score at home. Today, Mayor Rob Ford ended his bid for re-election due to some serious health concerns. Earlier in the week, he was admitted to hospital with severe abdominal pains, and doctors discovered a large mass or tumor. The results of that biopsy are expected in a few days, but obviously this is a serious health concern. And now, his brother, the equally brash, bombastic Doug Ford, a city councillor, has just announced that he's going to be stepping in and running for mayor in Rob's stead. Before he dropped out of the race, Rob Ford was trailing the front-runner John Tory by 12 points, according to one poll I've read. But get this, Rob, despite his health woes, insists he's going to run for his old city council seat in Etobicoke, North Ward 2. I tell you, municipal politics in this town, at least for the last 4 years, never a dull moment. And some excitement in the skies overhead tonight as well, where the Northern Lights, Aurora Borealis, have arrived with a double whammy. According to a report by the CBC, the Northern Lights are expected to put on a show across Canada tonight, even in the south, thanks to the double impact from solar plasma hitting the earth today. The combined effect should light up the skies pretty good over Canada, according to William Murtaugh, program coordinator for the NOAA Space Weather Prediction Center in Boulder, Colorado. But it could also cause some GPS, electrical grid, and radio disruptions. The latest update from the Space Weather Prediction Center, posted at 9:15 yesterday, recommends that aurora watchers look for possible activity tonight through Saturday night, as far south as New York, Wisconsin, and Washington State. Two eruptions from solar storms earlier this week, blasted plasma from the surface of the sun toward the Earth, a phenomenon known as a coronal mass ejection, or CME. Incidentally, the power consumed in an aurora display is much greater than the power usage in the United States. So if you get a chance, get outside, enjoy the show, but let's hope the beautiful Northern Lights leave Coast to Coast AM alone tonight. Friday night, of course, means open lines in the last half of the program. So in hours 2, 3, and 4, you can call in, jump in the co-pilot seat, and help fly this ship. I spent much of today doing something I don't get to do much anymore, and that's immerse myself in a good piece of fiction. Most of the reading I do to prepare for this show and my weekly radio program, The Conspiracy Show, as you can well imagine, tends to be of the non-fiction variety. But in anticipation for tonight's show, I got lost in a real page-turner. And I'm about halfway through book one in the Blackwater Lights trilogy, a sci-fi horror story with elements of the supernatural. And without giving too much away, the main character, Ray Simon, receives a desperate call from his childhood friend Kevin, begging him to come visit. Ray can't say no, so Kevin promises to clue him in on shocking discoveries he's made about weird, half-forgotten events in their past. Events associated with a summer camp near Kevin's home in the small town of Blackwater, West Virginia. Well, we're having just a little bit of a technical here problem. Okay, here we go. Sorry. But when Ray arrived, my computer, I don't know if that has anything to do with the Northern Lights or not. Anyway, when Ray arrives, Kevin is nowhere to be found, so Ray does some investigating of his own, only to find that no records exist of the camp. Yet he's not alone in looking for information. There's Lily, a beautiful redhead with an uncanny seductive power. Crawford, a wealthy collector of art and people. And Micah, the mysterious leader of the Church of the Open Door. All of them are seeking information about the rumored camp, and they're all interested, very interested, in Ray. Then a midnight encounter with a strange floating light sparks a return of old memories, vivid but fractured images that haunt Ray's waking hours with intimations of terror and cruelty. Something dreadful happened at that camp long ago, Something was awakened there. Now, with the help of his new friend Ellen, a waitress at the local diner, Ray must navigate a path through madness and murder, a path that leads inexorably to an all but forgotten night in his childhood and to a future of unimaginable horror. If you're into Dean Koontz, and I'm a fan, or maybe you dial back to H.P. Lovecraft, I know you're going to enjoy the work of my guest in the first hour, Michael M. Hughes. We've got a lot to talk about because some of the events in this supernatural thriller are based on Michael's personal experiences. He's had a lifelong fascination with things paranormal, with shamanism and psychoactive plants. If he's starting to sound like he's a kindred spirit with the late Terence McKenna, I suspect he just might be. So, let us gather around the electronic bonfire and talk of the paranormal, the supernatural, the unseen world. While above, Aurora Borealis performs its hypnotic cosmic fandango. You're listening to Coast AM. Michael Hughes has always had a fascination with the strange, mysterious, and esoteric. In grade school, he found a book on psychic magic in his local library and began a practice of mentalism, or psychic magic, that followed him into adult life where he performed professionally. Hughes has been deeply intrigued by the paranormal and has had a number of profound, unusual experiences that have convinced him of the need for an expanded worldview beyond the simplistic lens of materialism. His lifelong experiences and study of the paranormal are channeled into his fiction as a way to explore them more deeply. His best-selling debut novel, Blackwater Lights, was released by Hydra, or Random House, in 2013, followed by the sequel, Witch Lights, in 2014. When he's not writing, Hughes lectures on a smorgasbord of paranormal and Freudian topics, including UFOs, psychic phenomena, psychedelics, ritual magic, and secret societies. Hey, Michael, welcome to Coast.
Hey, thanks a lot, Richard. It's great to be here. I've listened to the show since the Art Bell days of yore.
Ah, well, I'm so pleased to be able to hang out with you and compare notes. Where are you at tonight?
I'm in Baltimore, so I don't think there's going to be much chance of the Aurora Borealis, but I'll check anyway when I go outside.
All right. Listen, I'm about halfway through Blackwater Lights, and I'm looking forward to diving into the sequel, Witch Lights. It's haunting. Your main character in the Blackwater trilogy sees some strange lights in the wilds of West Virginia, which reawaken these dark and repressed childhood memories. And I'm certain there are some Coast listeners out there who can relate. Sketchy childhood memories, lights in the sky, missing time. You know where I'm going with this. But Michael, you say the paranormal elements in your books are based upon your real life experiences. Can you tell us about the experience that was sort of the genesis for this story?
Yeah, I sure can. I mean, I do think there are probably a lot of listeners out there who share sort of similar memories and experiences in their own past. But really, the genesis of Blackwater Lights was an experience I had in 1990. I was in my 20s, and I was at the beach at Ocean City, Maryland. And I was out walking with my girlfriend along the beach. It was a beautiful night, absolutely clear, gorgeous, star-filled sky. And to backtrack just a little bit, the night before this happened, I had a dream, a really profound dream that really hit me hard. And it was a dream about a TV show with a panel of ufologists. And they really spanned the whole spectrum of ufology. There was like kind of a Stanton Freeman-esque nuts and bolts UFOs guy. There was sort of a Jacques Vallée guy who was talking about consciousness. And there was a David Icke, they're reptilians, they're going to eat our children kind of guy on the panel. And they were all arguing back and forth. And when I woke up from this dream, it really struck me that this was a really good metaphor for ufology, is so many different people just talking at each other and no one really listening. So, jump forward again to this evening. I was still thinking about this dream, and I was walking along the beach, and my girlfriend was down by the water. I was a little ways back just admiring the stars. And I looked up, and I did something I had never done before. Mentally, and probably 89% is sort of a joke, I said in my mind while looking at the sky, I said, okay, this is such a beautiful, clear night. There's no one around for miles. It was September, so it wasn't vacation time. The beach was completely empty. So I looked up and said, there's no one around. if you're out there, why don't you show yourselves? Show yourselves to me. And again, you know, this is, I was maybe 3%, maybe 2% thinking that something might actually happen. Well, about a few minutes later, my girlfriend yells to me. She goes, "What's that? What's that?" So I ran over and looked up, and I followed where she was pointing at the sky, and there were two very bright, glowing orange lights. And when I looked at them, they were just sort of bobbing next to each other, sort of stationary, but bobbing almost as if they were floating on the water. And then as soon as I sort of looked at them, they started moving across the sky in these really remarkable patterns. And I grew up near an airport near what used to be BWI Airport in Baltimore, so I know what things do in the sky. And these lights were just astounding, the way they were flying, the patterns that they were flying in.
These were no Chinese lanterns, in other words.
Yeah. Well, you know, of course, it's easy to... That's the first default sort of answer that anyone has. But this was in the period before people were, you know, setting off a lot of Chinese lanterns. And the way they were moving was not blowing. I mean, they were propelled. They were clearly moving in a way that was, you know, extremely fast and not being blown about by the wind. And then at one point, after they were doing these incredible sort of acrobatics, they came together and fused as one and flew a little ways like that and then split up again. And the whole time I'm watching this, I remember just saying, "Oh my God, oh my God, oh my God." You know, it was like there was nothing else I could say. And my girlfriend standing next to me is going, "Oh my God, oh my God, oh my God."
Right. What need more be said?
What's that?
I say, what more need be said?
Right, yeah.
Like that.
I mean, when you're in a situation when you see something that astounding, you know, I'm surprised I could even speak, but I was just repeating that litany over and over again. And then after they split up, all of a sudden they just shot across the sky and completely disappeared so fast. And you hear these sorts of things when people talk about their sightings, but to see something move that fast was just astounding. And even thinking about it now, like the hair on the back of my neck is standing up. So after these lights disappeared, I just remember this feeling. It was kind of awe, you know, in a way that's a sense of just having seen something that can't be possible, you know, but having seen it. And I was just completely astounded. And though I've had lots of other, you know, unusual experiences in my life, that remains the pivotal moment where it just shook me to my core. I'd always been interested in UFOs, you know, even as a kid. My father would read books by, you know, Brad Steiger and Frank Edwards, little, you know, paperbacks, leave them all around the house. So, I'd always had a fascination with the subject, but I never thought I'd actually see something like that. But even more profoundly was the fact that I had sort of asked to see it. And
right.
So, you know, either that was the most amazing coincidence, you know, and coupled with the dream the night before that sort of set things up, you know, either that was a off-the-charts profound coincidence, or that somehow these things actually can react to our thoughts. You know, these things, whatever they are. I'm not even saying that they're, you know, they didn't look like structured crafts. They were glowing, very bright lights that were moving in ways that I've never seen anything in the sky move like before. And somehow they seem to be related to our consciousness, and they can respond somehow to our conscious desire to see them.
So how did this experience change the way you think about UFOs? I mean, you just didn't have a sighting of strange lights in the sky, as you say. It was accompanied by the synchronicities and coincidences and a prescient dream.
Yeah, it really, you know, like a lot of people, I'd always sort of thought that, well, UFOs, they have to be spaceships, you know. I mean, that's just kind of the default. People say, "Oh, I saw a UFO," and people instantly think spaceships. But it really pushed me to think of other possibilities, and the fact that these, whatever these things are, that somehow they function on a psychic level. And it pushed me to really re-examine the ideas of people like Jacques Vallée, Terence McKenna, who you mentioned in the beginning, and to look at and to think that maybe what these things are more related to our consciousness than they are structured things flying around. Now, clearly, they are objects that have physical features, and there's physical traces of them, radar and photographs and videos and things like that. But maybe somehow they're both physical and, psychic. And I really could, I wrote to people at the time. There was I was on CompuServe. This dates me. Back to the days when the internet was little dial-up bulletin boards, and Whitley Strieber, whose books I'd read, was on CompuServe, and I remember, laboriously typing out this account and sending it to him, and he replied with a short sentence that chilled me completely. And to all of what I wrote to him explaining that experience, he said, "Maybe they wanted you to come out and play."
Yes,
that would chill anyone to the bone. As a horror writer, that really, that really raised my hackles. And later on, not that long ago, before he died, I met Bud Hopkins at a conference, and I talked to Bud, and we emailed back and forth a few times after the conference, and he said something to me which really shook me as well. And he said, and I'll quote because I have it written down here. He said, "As to your beach incident, my question is, who set that up? Did you ask for the aerial show, or was your presence there that night just parts of a scenario in which you unknowingly were helplessly following their script?" Now,
wow.
I thought about that, and I really would prefer to believe that I was not manipulated, that somehow this dream was not sort of, seated in my consciousness, that I wasn't somehow, against my own volition, perhaps, brought to witness this. But it sure is interesting to think about.
Indeed. And it's interesting that, you're trying to find ways of expanding your view of reality that goes beyond the lens of materialism. And yet we're all sort of, not all of us, but many of us are still stuck looking at the UFO ET phenomena through that same lens of materialism, that we assume that these are physical being and with, physical crafts. And yet, we know that in many eyewitness accounts, these things flit in and out of reality.
Yeah, I keep going back to Jacques Vallée because I really think he's one of the more perceptive ufologists. And he created waves when he first published, I think it was 5 arguments against the extraterrestrial hypothesis. And I've spoken to a lot of ufologists over the years and a lot of writers and things. And, I don't necessarily refute the extraterrestrial hypothesis. I mean, it's very possible that these things, whatever they are from another planet or another dimension or from a different, era in time. I'm not really sure, but the thing that Vallée talked about that really stuck with me, he said, these are technological entities, whatever they are, and they're capable of manipulating time and space in ways that we don't understand, but they also manipulate our psychic environment. And I think that's why when different people have encounters with whatever this intelligence is behind this phenomenon, they have different experiences, and because it's being filtered through their consciousness. So I've always believed that where the skeptics get it wrong is the skeptics, or I should say debunkers or pseudo-skeptics, because I think anyone who's a real skeptic and takes the time to look at this stuff understands that there is something to it. There is clearly something physical that has effects in the objective world. So that's where the pseudo skeptics go wrong. They don't see the evidence. They won't accept the evidence. But I think where some of the more hardcore, believers, for lack of a better word, go wrong, is they they don't understand that this experience is being filtered through someone's consciousness. It's a psychic experience that they're having. So, I don't necessarily accept if someone tells me that these entities came into their bedroom and said they were from Zeta Reticuli. You know, maybe they are, maybe they're not. Maybe that's just what they told you.
Right. The experience, I think we have to accept their explanation, their unpacking of that experience, that we can quibble with. Michael, we'll take a time out, come back, and talk about something called attempted manipulation of UFO manifestations. Michael Hughes, my guest, author of the Blackwater Lights trilogy. Back with more of Coast. My name is Richard Serrett. Welcome back. Sitting in for George Norrie. We'll get back to my conversation with author Michael Hughes about shamanism and the paranormal. Just wanted to mention, our webmaster tonight, Sean Latasor, has posted a great video up in the highlights section at coasttocoastam.com. The International Space Station is flying over the globe, and astronauts aboard, Mike Hopkins and Rick Mastracchio, are identifying different world cities as they fly by. So they're playing a little Name That City. I also wanted to give you a heads up. Let me just do that a little bit later, but let me get back to Michael Hughes here in a moment. But he was talking about Terence McKenna, and we're going to get into shamanism and philosophy and psychoactive plants. These are things that McKenna and Hughes share in common. But here's what Terence McKenna had to say about UFOs. He said, the UFO is nothing more than an assertion of herself by the goddess into history, saying to science and paternalistically governed and driven organizations, you have gone far enough. We are going to turn the world upside down. Your science is going to be shown up for what it is, nothing more than a pleasant metaphor usefully extrapolated into the production of toys for healthy children. That's what science is good for. It's not some meta-theory at whose feet every point of view from astrology to acupressure to channeling need be laid to have the hand of science announce thumbs up or thumbs down. Back with more of my conversation with Michael Hughes as we discuss shamanism, the paranormal, and UFOs right here on Coast to Coast. Welcome back to Coast AM. Richard Serrett sitting in for George Norrie. Michael Hughes, my guest, writer, author of a new trilogy, Blackwater Lights, and the second installment in that trilogy is Witch Lights. I want to talk to you about something called attempted manipulation of UFO manifestations. You write about this, Michael. Explain what that means.
Well, yeah, that's actually a quote from an old interview I found with Jacques Vallée, and it really stuck with me because of my experience and what seemed to be me asking for something to appear and then it appearing. And what Vallée was talking about is as his thoughts started to change about what these things were, he started talking to occultists and people who did ritual magic and things like that. And he found out that some of them claimed that they could invoke alien beings or entities through the things that they did. And he called that, in that particular interview, said attempted manipulation of UFO manifestations. And he said he had spoken to occultists and he knew them that claimed they could do it. And if you look at ritual magic, which I've written about quite a bit, I mean, the whole purpose is to summon or conjure entities. So there are a lot of really really solid parallels there. And I started looking at the idea of discarnate entities and bringing forth entities or contacting them. So that led me down all sorts of paths, including shamanism, which when you break it down is really just a shaman who goes into a trance and goes to other places and often works with allies or spirits or entities, whatever you might want to call them. So all of these similarities, these coincidental things, just started popping out of various forms of literature. And what they all had in common was an alteration of consciousness, whether it's through plants, whether it's through drugs, whether it's through ritual. And And all of these seem to be methods, even though they're very diverse, and the people who practice them are all very different, all seem to have a common element of contacting, making contact or summoning or bringing forth these entities, whatever they are, these intelligences. And what fascinated me is, well, what are, if we can assume that some sort of reality to what these people are saying. And, you know, again, when you start talking ontologically, it gets, you know, I mean, you could go down all sorts of crazy paths and avenues, but I tend to think that there's objective reality, and there's what Henry Corbin called the mundus imaginalis, which is the world of the imagination. And not that elements in that world are imaginary, and I think that's where we in the West go wrong a lot of times, but the fact that there are, in the imaginal world, this threshold world between the objective and the subjective inner world, there's a reality to that. Things can manifest there. Things can live there. Things can exist there. And that's what all of these different practices try to do, is to contact whatever these entities are, whatever you want to call them, spirits or demons or, you know, self-dribbling basketballs, you know, Terrence McKenna talked about in his DMT research. So what I started looking at is how people have attempted to bring these things into their consciousness or into their awareness, or in the case of what happened to me, actually into the sky above me. And so that led me to explore all sorts of avenues of shamanism, particularly psychoactive plants. I'm sure there have been lots of guests that have talked about DMT, Rick Strassman's DMT research, and so forth.
Ayahuasca.
In ayahuasca. What actually wound up happening to me was I was working with melatonin, which is an over-the-counter norohormone that people use for sleep, for jet lag, and it tends to really amplify your dreams as well. It's really profoundly deepened and intensified my dreams. So I was using relatively high doses of melatonin. And I was at a bed and breakfast with a woman I was dating at the time, and that the night I took, I think it was probably about 10 milligrams or maybe 10, 12 milligrams of melatonin, and I had a classic sleep paralysis experience. I woke up completely, absolutely paralyzed, but wide awake, and I could only move my eyes, and I was absolutely convinced, as happens with sleep paralysis, that there's some malign entity in the room. I was completely and utterly convinced that this thing was going to not just kill me, but take my soul. You know, I mean, that's how horrific it was. Well, as a lot of sleep paralysis incidents do, I just fell asleep. And when I woke up the next day, my girlfriend looked at me and she said, "What's that on your chest?" And I had to go look in the mirror, and there was a bright red handprint on my chest. But the strange thing was that the hand was much bigger than my own. It was bright red, almost as if it had been painted on my chest, or I'd been slapped really hard. And the more I looked at it, I realized this thing had six fingers. So I tried and...
Six? Come again? I mean, did you say six fingers?
It had six fingers.
Oh, Lord.
Yeah. So I tried to twist my hand to fit this, you know, pattern on my chest, this handprint, and there was no way, you know, because I thought, well, maybe I was sleeping on my hand in front of you or something like that. There was no way I could fit my hand to this thing, and not to mention that I only have a thumb and four fingers, like most people. So that was another, you know, that I felt like that night that it made me think more about sleep paralysis, and that, you know, it's, you know, a reductionist would say, well, it's just, you know, acetylcholine in your brain and blah, 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 this sort of thing happening. But it really made me wonder if incidents like that, when your consciousness is dramatically altered, is that maybe that's sort of a doorway for whatever these things are. Because whatever I encountered in that moment of absolute terror, you know, it left a mark on me, you know, a physical mark on me. So it's really hard for me to sit back and say, or to listen to people when they dismiss, you know, alien abductions. Oh, all these people are just having sleep paralysis incidents. Well, you know, I think that maybe sleep paralysis might be related to those so-called abductions. But rather than just explaining them away, you know, maybe sleep paralysis is an altered state of consciousness, and that opens up some sort of doorway.
So it sounds like you're starting to formulate some sort of common current or cause among all of these kinds of experiences.
I think so. And what's always fascinated me is the fact that, you know, cross-culturally, shamanic cultures and you know, but even going back to Western, you know, Western esotericism, there is always some sort of belief that there are other things among us, you know, discarnate, you know, whether people call them angels, fairies, demons, you know, aliens, whatever, that there are these other beings that exist somehow in the threshold between our world and the imaginal world. And if all these cultures, this is part of all these cultures, so it's a transcultural global phenomenon that we as humans somehow develop beliefs in these things, and we also develop technologies for somehow interacting with them. So let's say that's a given. Well, what are these things? I mean, I've spent the past, you know, 25 years digging deeply into, you know, all sorts of esoteric practices, all sorts of historical accounts and things. And I'm no closer to having an idea of what they are, but I wonder, what are they? What do they want with us? Why are they so interested in communicating with us and having us communicate with them? I mean, clearly, there's a tricksterish element to these entities. You know, they tell people, you know, that the world is going to end in, you know, next year, and it doesn't happen. I mean, there's a tricksterish element that seems to be that they're playing with us. They seem to be able to change their shape and to what we might want them to look like or what we might think they might look like. And most importantly, they have a power to interact with our consciousness. So what are they? You know, that's really become the overriding sort of quest for me, intellectually as well as practically, trying to determine what is going on here.
Sure. Michael, do you think that maybe we focus too much on what are they, rather than, I mentioned a quote from Terence McKenna, and he was sort of asking the question, what do they do, rather than what are they, what do they do? And he talked about how they seem to be here to show up science for what it is, nothing more than a pleasant metaphor, usefully extrapolated into the production of toys for healthy children. He says that's what science is good for, and that's what these strange lights in the sky appear to be doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you know, Terence was a brilliant thinker, and there's a quote of his I regularly roll out when I do talks, and he asked if we're in a symbiotic relationship with something that disguises itself as an extraterrestrial invasion so as not to alarm us. And I think you're very right, and I think for the longest time, ufologists have focused on trying to get, you know, pieces of a craft or you know, photographic evidence that's going to conclusively once and for all prove that these things exist and so forth, you know, physical evidence, when really these things are affecting our culture. They're generating a new mythology. They're very much you know, I also love listening to Jeffrey Kripal, who I know has been on the show a few times. You know, he's a scholar of religion, and he talks about the UFOs and other paranormal phenomena as very much religious and very much spiritual. elements, and I think it's very true, you know. But what? Why are they so tricksterish? You know, why are they? Is the evidence always just out of our grasp? You know, are they leading us somewhere? Are they trying to help us evolve intellectually? Are they trying to open us up to a higher reality or a more multidimensional reality? It's certainly very possible. But I don't know. You know, it's always just out of grasp. And just when you think you have, you know, you have your hands around it, it just completely slips away. So that's why I love listening to people's stories, because that's where we learn what these experiences are, when we listen to stories. And that's why I talk about this stuff. I mean, you know, a lot of people are afraid to talk about these things, as you know. I mean, luckily, a show like this, you get a lot of people who are very open about their experiences. But I find that when I give a talk, people come up to me afterwards, or people email me and say, you know, God, I have to tell you this experience that I had. And that's where we really learn. It's not, you know, I'm all for trying to find, you know, the ultimate piece of physical evidence that proves that something physically real is going on. But I'm really more interested, and I think we get a lot more out of listening to people's stories and seeing how people change when they have these experiences. You know, going all the way back to visions of demons and gods and antiquity, all the way up to today, when someone comes up to me after I give a talk and says, you know, I've never told anyone this before, but, you know, I had this experience with a light in my room, and then I woke up, you know, out on a hill, you know, half a mile away, things like that. So the more we listen to people's stories, and again, you brought up a great point when you said we can listen to their stories and believe them. And it's something that I learned from Jerry Clark. He said you can listen to people's stories. We can believe that they had these experiences. You don't have to believe their explanations for what they are. And I think you hit on a really solid point. We know people are having these experiences. We don't necessarily have to buy what they're telling us, what their interpretation is or their translation.
Right. I was watching one of your UFO presentations online, Michael, and you talked about the UFO wave, of course, over Washington, D.C. in 1952. You talked about going back to 47, of course, the wave in 47 with Kenneth Arnold. And but you skipped over Roswell, and you said, I don't even like to talk about Roswell because I think it's a swamp. What did you mean by that?
Yeah, you know, Roswell, I've called it a swamp. I've called it a black hole. You know, a vortex. I just think it's so, there's so much misinformation, disinformation. You know, it's a truly interesting story. And, you know, like many people, I was, you know, deeply immersed in it for the longest time. But then, you know, it just seems like it's like a giant void. Like, you could put so much energy into trying to figure out what exactly happened at Roswell, and we're still back at the starting point. You know, you either buy, you know, Jesse Marcel's account and other people have testified, or, you know, some of the ideas of, you know, that there were test flight dummies or something, which I think is ridiculous, but it's just a giant black hole of that I've seen too many people get sucked into. And it's just like a lot of ufology nowadays, it's just regurgitated the same stuff over and over again. And these are great cases. You know, I could listen to accounts of, you know, Betty and Barney Hill and Travis Walton. And, you know, I love this stuff. I mean, I grew up on it. It's part of my mythology, but it seems like we've gotten stuck. We're stuck with the same stuff over and over again. And now it's even more difficult with all the CGI technology available. Like, you can't trust any videos anymore, really. So I think it's kind of forced us to look more at the human aspects of this phenomenon. And that's always where I think that's where we learn the most, how people are affected, what their stories are, what they tell us is happening, how they change. And it plays into a lot of the psychedelic research that I've written about. Like I wrote the first feature on the Johns Hopkins psilocybin study that studied mystical experiences and if they could be generated with psilocybin. And I know the researchers, and I talked to them, and I talked to a lot of the volunteers. And the real beauty of that research is not the fact that a chemical can change someone, but the fact that people are changed and how they change.
All right, Michael, I'll jump in here. We'll take a time out. We'll reconnoiter on the other side. Michael M. Hughes, author of the Blackwater Lights trilogy, talks about shamanism. Rolling Stones, take us out with I'll Follow the River.